Wait, are you gaming? On a Chromebook?
Yep. It's got a high-res 120Hz display, plus this killer RGB keyboard. And I can access thousands of games anytime, anywhere.
Stop playing.
What?
Get out of here.
Huh?
Yeah, I want you to stop playing and get out of here so I can game on that Chromebook.
Got it.
Go ahead, break it down real low. Discover the ultimate cloud gaming machine, a new kind of Chromebook.
Football is back, and we have you covered each weekday afternoon on OutKick's Hot Mic with Hutton and Withrow.
Some of the best football guests, from Armando Salguero and John McClain to Trey Wallace and Bobby Carpenter, plus the top headlines and reaction to the college football and NFL weekends.
The Chiefs go for dynasty mode with Patrick Mahomes, Travis Kelce, and Andy Reid.
They're the favorite, right?
Yeah, they have to be. The AFC goes through Arrowhead, but the Bengals and Jets, they're all in to reach Vegas. And the Bills and Dolphins are also confident. Withrow, what about college football?
Can you say three-peat? That's what they're hoping to say in Athens, Georgia, as the Bulldogs continue their march to college football dominance, while a cast of usual characters led by Michigan, Ohio State, and Bama nip at their heels.
There's plenty of craziness on a week-to-week basis. Pull up to the bar with us each weekday afternoon. We're streaming live 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern across the OutKick Network. Podcasts available everywhere, and always check out OutKick.com.
NFL and college football covering your favorite teams. OutKick's Hot Mic with Hutton and Withrow.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a bonus episode of There Will Be Dungeons. This is a Q&A episode where we sit around roundtable style and answer your questions that have been flooding in since about 30 days ago. And we do this every month. So thanks, first of all, for supporting us. If you're getting this early, you know who you are. And we're really grateful for you. So keep that up and tell your friends about how this works, because maybe they'd want this bonus info as well. They get it late, but they get it really late. You're the tip of the spear. So thank you guys so much. All right, let's get back to it. Kristen has a bunch of questions compiled for all of us, and we'll start with those. Kristen, what do you have?
All right, first one. Has Bo considered having a wild, magic-esque table for when Scott/Nash licks or eats unusual stuff? Also, has there ever been something Bo has put in the campaign intentionally for Nash/Scott to eat? And if so, did Scott take the bait?
Oh, this is a great question. I want to know, too.
Yeah, so I can answer. The first one was, have I ever considered putting anything for Nash to eat? Is that right?
A magic, wild magic-esque table.
Oh, like table. Yeah, it was the table. Sorry. That's why. Okay, yeah. I forgot. So I've definitely considered it, but it's hard to predict. And yes, I've considered it. That's okay. What I'm going to answer.
So you've considered it, but haven't, so that means he may still. What about the other
thing? I just don't want to over-explain. So I've considered it, yes.
Okay.
And has Nash, you know, has there ever been anything planted for Nash to lick? I don't want to answer that question.
Ooh.
Why? Now I need to know. Really? You can't say, because you've done it. That means you've done it.
It's a little bit too. I don't want to give away too much of my logic.
That
on
means
this
you've
We're
done it. I
game.
Ate a mushroom and it gave us light. That was it. Probably.
No. I mean, I definitely put all kinds of things in for all the players to play with, but also I put innocuous things in that I don't have any clue he's going to lick, and that happens too. So
okay.
A little bit of both.
All right.
Let's say.
Now I just
so
have
it's
to
a
guess.
Little wild magic-esque. You never know what's going to be taken and what.
Yeah. I guess if somebody wants to know how the sausage gets made, I don't exclusively rely on any tables, but the tables are tools that are there to use if the context permits it.
Sure.
Fair enough. How does Stanley feel knowing that Nash had a probable hand in just about all his life? Will he go down the rabbit hole of if Nash didn't time travel and probably say something stupid, my family might still be alive?
I don't know if he would go that far. I mean, we got into a little bit of it in today's episode. I don't think... Stanley loves to pick on Nash, and he has a very brotherly relationship with Nash where it's he likes to tease him, he likes to mess with him, but I don't think he would see Nash as being at fault for any of this, and he certainly doesn't hate it just because it's Nash, but he definitely has complicated feelings about the whole thing. I just don't think right now, at the very least, they're aimed at Nash.
Mm. Yeah, he has every right to be. It's like finding out that, oh gosh, what's a good example for this? It's like finding out the pivotal point of the entire Star Wars saga ends up being a Jawa or something. It's just Jar-Jar. Like, it's like, what? Freaking, yeah, or Jar Jar Binks, another good example. Like, you don't want to hear that. The whole time you've been, you know, it's easy to get dismissive of Nash's, like, coarser behavior or his just, like, bumbling attitude, or he wants to eat everything, or he doesn't trust some stuff but trusts other things. You know, all this bull crap that he does, you don't want to then find out that, oh my gosh, he's the, you know, he's the King Arthur of this story. Not the King Arthur. I don't want to make it like that. But you know what I mean? Like, he has an important pivotal thing to play here. I feel bad for anyone who has to watch Nash suddenly find out he has a bigger role to play.
It's like you are grateful to live in a world that has Deadpool in it. You love his movies. Yep. You love that he exists. But if Deadpool just randomly showed up and was the one who defeated Thanos, you'd probably be like, wait, what just happened?
Yeah, exactly. Everybody got there, was about to say Avengers Assemble or whatever, and then suddenly he comes and just does it, and everyone's standing there. Like, there is that feeling, and I get it. So I wouldn't blame Stanley for having his misgivings about it. I would if I were Stanley. And I think Nash has misgivings about it. I don't like he doesn't like the pressure. He doesn't like the responsibility of knowing there's more there. Like, the character doesn't. I like seeing how it's going to play out, but
yeah,
Nash doesn't want it. He doesn't want that. With great power comes great responsibility. He doesn't want any.
Exactly. We didn't even want kids, but here they are.
Yeah.
Four of them. All right, Varel, do you still consider the dragons gods after traveling around the cosmos and experiencing everything Varel has, especially now that he's witnessed one die to lowly die in Talos?
It's pretty messed up. We didn't address it today because it didn't come up, but there's definitely that continuation of the Squirt's death going on, where just nobody can be trusted outside the group, and no one will survive or is powerful enough to be with the group. However, there is still the Sigil Lady, Maiden of Pain, right? And she still blew his mind. Lady of Pain, yeah. So that would be a current representation of a god. But yes, it is a little world-shattering that a dragon jumped out and immediately died. In fact, died faster than Varel would have. Or maybe Varel was winning in his mind, which makes it even worse.
Yeah.
Also, lowly die in Talos.
Yeah, come right.
Now, let's not take pot shots in the middle of our questions.
I think everyone's pretty excited for that.
You've been wanting to dust that off for a while. Yeah, I don't blame you.
If we could script this, because we can't, I would give you the lines to read when I played die in Talos. That's amazing. But it's not scripted.
No.
How would you all rate your character friendships from early campaign to now? I.e., who did Hope feel closest to when they started playing versus who she feels closest to now in the group?
Oh,
that one's funny.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that. I mean, so, you know, Stanley and Nash have this thing where they're just, you know, irritated with each other or whatever. I don't think that's changed much. I think that's kind of the same as it's always been. And when push comes to shove and crap
each other quite a bit.
Yeah. When stuff, when poop's about to hit the fan, we tend to come together when it matters. But then during the off time, you know, we're kind of off putting to each other. And that's never really changed, I don't think. Not really.
I think for the beginning, Stanley probably genuinely didn't like Nash. Like, I think he probably saw, like, the Thunderwave incident in episode 1 and was like, oh, it's a guy that's going to get all of us killed. That's somebody that we shouldn't have around. And he probably genuinely didn't much care for Nash, but I think very quickly, like, he became endearing to him. Like, for Stanley spent a lot of time in the early campaign telling himself he didn't care about these people. And I don't think it was true for most of it, but I think he tried to convince himself for a very long time that that was how he felt about it, even though his actions probably suggested otherwise. And so I don't think his relationships have changed all that much. I know it's probably more strained with Varel. I mean, when we were just out reading the dictionary together while Hope and Nash adventured, Like, that was probably peak friendship for them, and it's probably more of a strained relationship now as they've struggled to have their two viewpoints coexist. But I think overall Stanley has always liked Varel, and I don't think that has changed, despite the fact that they butt heads probably more often.
Yeah, I will say this. When we early on in the campaign, Nash felt an overwhelming thing where he felt like he had to protect Hope. That was like a weirdly paramount thing for him. He didn't even express it that often. He just felt like he had to do it. And he's still loyal in that way. If she says we're doing this, then we're doing that. So that's still a thing. But she's proved herself to be so much more formidable than even he is, power wise, that he doesn't. He no longer, you know, it's no longer like, oh, I got to protect her. It's more like, oh, she probably should protect me from myself half the time. That kind of thing is definitely a thing with that character. But my relationship with Varel hasn't changed at all. Like, he's still who he is. We have a very good sort of collaborative workplace relationship, I think. Varel and Nash do.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
We certainly end up on the team. Just ask the damn question. Let's go straight there. Where as Stanley and Hope have all these trappings and responsibilities and social
backstory.
Obligations. Yeah. That just get in the way of just hitting the guy in the mouth that you got to hit, asking the question you got to ask.
Right. There is an efficiency to that relationship, and it goes into combat as well. It's like, my first thought is, what can I do to Varel to make him bigger, stronger, faster, better? Like, what am I doing to do that? Because to me, he's our blunt instrument, and everybody else supports that in some way. So that's always on deck. Like, I don't know, that relationship hasn't changed really at all. And is still, I think, it's an efficient relationship between two very, very different creatures in this world. Like, they couldn't be more different, but they're compatible in that way.
Yeah, and then like Hope kind of come at it. Well, it started very Road Warrior. So it was more, this group was very, very amusing, very funny to watch and kind of get into scraps with. But now it's been really cool with Stanley, because Hope's really kind of seen just how similar their backgrounds are. And so that's kind of opening this, she feels like she has a family again, kind of a thing. And then with the arm and her, she's very aware that she has an impending death coming. So that's kind of really hit her hard over these past few episodes, where she was just kind of sitting there thinking. And yeah, so they're family now. I think Hope's really kind of reached an emotional maturity. She's let go of the past a bit.
Yep.
For the DM, are there character growth moments that have made you the happiest, proudest, or most shocked from or of the players?
Wow, there isn't just one. There are like hundreds. So it's like trying to pick from your favorite children. In particular, this last run of episodes, I'm even kind of shocked at how, like, honestly, I know this is conceited or whatever, but how good they are. Like, I don't mean that as like because of me. I mean that because of you guys. Like, the last run from, like, I would mark a certain point from when you guys were picked up in Tiet Kala to like now. Everyone's just, I don't know, I guess a lot of stuff's getting revealed, a lot of lore's getting dropped, but there's a lot of, even just from that one divergence where you split into the two teams, a lot of misunderstandings arose, and a lot of things that weren't addressed in the past are just kind of all getting ironed out, and I can see everyone kind of changing along with their characters, I suppose, like trying to reorient themselves or look at what's happened in the past and feel like they're not that happy with the, you know, fall of Razak Vall and Tiet Kala and what's been going on, and that everyone's regrouping mentally to face their true enemies. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, this last run has been the best, and I don't know that I'm filled with tears of joy, but I think about it all week. Like, I think about it a lot, and I think about the things that you guys have done, and I watch back those, my favorite scenes. Yeah, if you're watching right now, this has been the best stuff, and I think you all know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Did Stanley get nerfed when he lost Diantalus? Did he have to level up again to make up for the loss?
I mean, Bo can talk more about this too, but I don't think Diantalus was ever very OP. It allowed me to once per day, and I didn't always have a say of who was in charge on what given day, and allowed me once per day to change my class to another class of the exact same level and the exact same stats, which maybe is a little OP, but I don't. It never felt that way. It felt more like a hindrance than anything to play Diantalus. From a mechanical standpoint, it did. It was sometimes freeing in that, you know, Diantalus was a little more on Varel's side and a little, it was easier to move the plot along. Like, oh, somebody's holding us up. Let's kill him. You know, that's an easy decision for Diantalus to make. That's a hard decision for Stanley to make. But I think Diantalus was very balanced. Does not need to be patched. He was fine.
Yes, I mean Stanley. Diantalus was. It's a little bit confounding because he is also the archfey of the pact that the character had. You know what I mean? So even though you were switching to Diantalus in another class, Diantalus was the being that the warlock would have entered into the relationship with. It's just weird because you're also playing as Diantalus while worshiping yourself.
Yeah. I always played it with the idea of an archfey is so incredibly powerful. You can't fit that in the body of a mortal. Like there's an essence and there's a knowledge and there's a power that just isn't going to fit. It's like too much liquid trying to go into too small of a cup.
Yeah.
And so I always kind of played it and treated it as this cup is as full as it can be, and he can't necessarily control what's in there, because theoretically Diantalus might have answers to questions we would have and could just very easily answer them if he was so inclined. But it's going to become very boring if I'm constantly asking Bo, you know, does Diantalus have the answer to that? Does Diantalus know this? So the idea was always that Stanley did not have full access to Diantalus. That's why he was a, you know, whatever the level was at the time that I was playing him, warlock. And he wasn't some insane god character permanently destroying stats with a swing of a scythe. He was like a warlock of that level. And that was kind of how I explained it and how it justified it in the game.
That's awesome. That's a great way to treat it in terms of, like you said, asking Bo all the time if Diantalus would know that information. Does anyone know what song or where the classical music that Scott uses for the pixie blush hallucination / bonbon attacks come from? I want to do a drug effect in my sessions, and that music is perfect.
Oh, man. I think I got that track from tabletopaudio.com, I think. Actually, I might have it right here. Let me just, for poops and giggles, see if I can find it. Yeah, so like so if you go to tabletopaudio.com and you go to, I think it's House on the Hill. There's a lot of haunting type stuff in there. It's meant for scenarios of, you know, people playing horror scenarios in their pen and paper games. And I think it's this right here. Let's play it. Is it playing? Oh. Yeah, this is it.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, so. It's just like, it's meant to actually be creepy, like as if there's a bunch of ghosts waltzing in the background. But for me, it works better as like a goot, like, a, oh no, we're.
There's definitely levity that I associate with that music. As soon as I hear it, I'm like, something silly's happening, but also like gross.
Yeah, if there's something about it.
Like, it's got you guys that haunted mansion feel, right?
Yeah, like, Nash, don't let him meet the bonbon. There's just something funny about that juxtaposition, which is why I used it. And I used it also for when Nash was hallucinating. So good call on that listener for catching it.
By the way, I think this qualifies you for co-DM credit because you're basically foleying and musicking Oliver's session. Normally the DM's job. So
what you're saying is I can give myself inspiration anytime I want. That's, you know, what you're saying? Okay.
You're not the DM of the game, but you are a co-DM.
All right.
Right.
So, you know, I just want to say, like, on that level of partnership, you know, if someone's like, if you can't really say you've never DM'd a game because you have some sense of what it's about by prepping songs and sounds for the experience.
Yeah. The hard part is scrambling for, like, you know, you guys are talking about, like ghosts are a problem for me. And I just happened to have a thing up that was like, oh no, this would be great because I'm going to have these weird little kids and this
Daddy, where's mommy?
Not that one. How about this one? Like this one. Like kids laughing and the heartbeat and all that. Like that was just at my fingertips. So it made sense for me to just pull that stuff up and go. Sometimes I'll scramble and not find what I want, but I try. I try to make it so it feels like we're
definitely at some points talking, it absolutely 1,000% enhances everything that's going on. Like whenever I've listened back to the audio version of the show.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. During the show, it's like present also in the video, but in the audio it really stands out.
And people should know this when we're doing it live, these guys they hear some of it, but they don't necessarily hear all of it because I'm keeping it low so it doesn't really distract from the game. But people at home will, both stream and you know, live people and the podcast. So far, nothing but great response to us even doing that. I hope that's true for most of our listeners, that they really...
I mean, I find it super good. You're right. The audio version is the best version for the Foley work and stuff. Because just the way Discord works, too. It just doesn't pipe it in correctly.
No.
Like a studio or anything. So, right. Yeah. But the audio product's good, as far as I can tell.
Well, good.
I really like it.
So there you go. And it's a great resource. I've mentioned it before on these bonus shows, but tabletopaudio.com is rad. They have all kinds of stuff that I use. I use things from all over the place, but this is definitely a resource I use.
We need one for your underwear.
Yeah, I'm working on that.
One day at a time.
Oh, I found it.
I have...
Here it is.
Oh, dude.
Just kidding. It's not...
That sounds like a laundry machine.
I know.
DM question coming up here. And of course, anyone can answer if they have ideas, but I've just started running a game for my family. This is my first time as DM and the first time playing for them. We're having a great time and we wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't for TWBD. My question is, as a DM, if you see the player doing something they don't need to, like holding on to their spells or rage for a fight that won't come, do you try to let them know or do you just stay silent? I thought of giving hints, but everything I could think of was too obvious. And one of the players is a child in their game.
Okay. Sorry. I think because of my ADHD, I actually just stopped listening halfway through the question. I'm really sorry about that. Can you just reframe it for me, please? Sorry.
Yeah. So let's say we're playing a game and all of us are holding on to our top level spells because we think an encounter is going to come up in this session. But as a DM, you know that encounter is not going to come up. So we should be free to use our cool stuff.
Yeah, that's just a tough thing with the design of the game. And, you know, if you've got a version of Kyle at your table, he's just going to accuse you of trying to...
He's going to call out the tricks.
Yeah, he's like DM metagaming. So if you have one of those at your table, you'll want to not do that because they'll call you out and then everyone will be on high alert. But the idea behind playing is that everyone's at the table to have fun. And so people feeling really anxious about not using their stuff. I mean, it causes me a great deal of pain too. And I'm sure you see it on the show when they're like, we don't want to use this. And I'm like, come on, just blow all your spells and turn into Tyrannosaurus. In order for people to feel a sense of danger that the world is real and hostile, just like in the real world, if you had, I don't know why you'd have a rocket launcher, but if you had a rocket launcher and only three rockets, if you're getting pulled over for speeding, you might not want to shoot the rocket at the police officer, right? Because you need to save those for real danger. So I think the game expressly has that dynamic of, yes, you've got powerful stuff, but you are not a god. You do not have unlimited fonts of power. You do have to make those decisions. And if players are too careful with their stuff and being stingy, then find interesting ways to punish them for it, without making it seem like you're expressly doing that. The best way is to just wrap up the adventuring day and have them go to bed with all their spell slots. They're going to start feeling like they're being silly. The other thing you can do as well is establish a protocol so that everyone has fun in advance by saying, like, I'm only planning on doing 2 to 3 encounters per traveling day. you know, for now, or just like have that discussion with the play group. Like, do you want me to think about that, or do you want me to not to think about that? And like, that's advice I'm giving you, but I didn't ask my play group. So we're only humans. If you can think of it, ask. If not, you might be doing 15 sessions over one day. And that's that takes place over one game day. So sometimes that's just how it goes. But generally speaking, in life, you don't know whether you should burn your big moves on any situation. So I don't see why anyone in D&D should be given that advice without, let's say, consulting with the gods. And you can let them know there's ways to consult with the gods if they'd like to be more religious. They might be able to get some of that advice, I guess, or anything else you can imagine in that way. You can give them advice without it being direct DM advice. If you can kind of push them towards an NPC or a situation that might help them make those decisions better. Cool. Was that a lot? I was all over the place, but good. I wasn't prepared for it.
That
was great. Yeah, no, that sounded great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And would you guys ever do a branched off type of adventure where you all play as the children of Nash?
Oh, dude, I would not ask anyone else to do that. Who wants to play freaking Fork or Spoon or whatever the hell his name is? Like, nobody wants
to be those kids.
Would want to play Fork and Spoon and Pipe.
Well,
and
what
Nash
I mean is like this weird offshoot of all, even though that stuff came from, you know, that's from the mind of Bo, which I highly respect or whatever. I feel bad. I feel bad if all my I'd feel bad if all my friends were not forced, but you know, felt pressured to be in a game where they had to play Nash's offspring. That just sounds like
there would be no pressure about it.
Yeah, you don't have to commit to anything. Like, these characters have no personality yet, so they could be a perfect reflection of Nash. They could be the anti-Nash. Like, they could be an extremely thoughtful, like, Pipe could come out and just be like, well, my father was a bit reckless. I don't think he handled things the way he necessarily should. So I will be very careful when I cast my spell, and I'd like to use all my sorcery points.
Look, if we do a campaign too, because I just don't like counting my chickens before they get hatched or anything, but I'm open to a lot of different things. I'll just say that.
Okay.
Including, you know, There'll Be Dungeons Part 2.
Those pretty
the son
fun.
Of Nash, the sons of Nash.
This is like the sitcom spinoff.
sons of Nasharchy.
Oh my lord. It's a terrible idea. But yes, if we had, you know, if there was some reason to do it, I suppose we could.
If you had to play one of your sons, which would it be, Scott?
Ooh. Probably.
Is it four sons? I thought there's a daughter in there too.
There's no daughters. They're all boys.
Was it all sons?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I don't know if we knew. I forget.
Well, I don't know if we know.
Actually, I guess I don't know. I've been assuming boys because we've never made a distinction.
I thought I said that information. I hope I wrote it down. So, well, it's on the show. I'll go back and
okay.
Listen. I mean,
well,
if
it's
you
hard
didn't
to
write
tell.
It down, we just make it up, right?
When they come out of boot, it's not like you're going, where's the vagina? Like, you don't know.
Yeah, I might have been so caught up in my secret plot that they were going to come out as the objects they were that I might have forgotten to even gender them. Yeah. Like in my mind, you know, like.
Sure. That's tricky. Yeah. It's tricky. Probably boot, because I think that's funny. I just think it's funny that the kid's a boot. So whether that boy or girl, doesn't matter. Boot's my favorite.
I want Nash Jr. to be the girl. If there's a girl, I want it to be Nash Jr. So
bad. We can make things happen.
We could.
Yes.
If it hasn't been decided yet, I mean, why not? We'd have to assume a lot, but.
I think we just decided.
I think we just decided that.
A big lore drops. That's, happening on the bonus show.
That's fantastic. Well done.
Oh, Burrell, is there anything you're going to do to honor Omnom, who indeed was his most honest and honorable follower and strongest dude single-handedly fighting off a horde of demons before you guys came?
Oh, I wish Artisan Craftsman was more interesting, but sadly it's super limited to just those few items that I normally make. Otherwise, in Varel's world, you vacate your body the second you die, the body isn't you anymore, and he would have made a slick pair of boots for somebody out of those feet. And they would have been glorious boots in the feet of Omnom. Leaving his footprints, no less. As you walk, you leave footprints of Omnom.
Wow.
I mean, the feet are still there.
That's true.
Yeah, they totally are still there.
Maybe you can send back some tieflings to go collect it for you.
Yeah. Get
did
on that.
Give any buffs?
Oh, yeah.
Buffs. Did you leave lizard footprints? What more do you want?
Yeah.
Yeah. What else is even there? That's it. It's the ultimate. I think we have time for at least one more. Do we have one more at least?
Yeah, of course. This one, was there any part of Stanley that gave thought to actually rejoining with Diantalus and maybe achieving godhood himself?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Stanley knows he's up against the ropes with his mission. Like, he very quickly realized how outclassed he was in just about every regard all the way through this journey. And that has been the nagging voice in the back of his head the entire time, was kind of what he told Hope tonight, which was the first bit was, you know, if you worked with me, we could do great things. And he set off initially to rebuild society. And his belief at the time was society at any cost. Like, I will be evil if it makes the world a better place. That's not a problem. That was the mantra he had in the beginning. And he quickly changed his tune, but it's always in the back of his mind as a possibility. He's actively fighting against it.
Nice. Well, one day, maybe we'll see you two reunited finally. The two lovers, Stanley and Diantalus. Anyway, we'll see how that goes. In the meantime, thank you for listening, everybody. There's our half hour show we do every month. And if you want more of these, well, then just keep supporting us and you'll get them very first thing as soon as they're done. It's going up today, which means you're hearing it tonight on November 1st, the first of the month. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next month with another, and of course, a bunch of episodes of the actual show in between. If you have any questions for us, thoughts, or comments, head on over to the website. You'll find everything you need. There will be dungeons.com. We'll see you guys next time.